connection. Now, it can be shown, and if you'd like to see it, I can do it on the blackboard later on, that if you treat, or you try and treat the Chern-Simons functional as a dilator, then it acts by dilations on the volume operator. Well, almost, but not quite. You see, the thing is that, remember that I'm using gamma equals to I, so I have a complex self-dual connection. So when I expand the Chern-Simons functional in terms of that connection, I'm going to get a real part and an imaginary part, right? So I can't just take that Chern-Simons and define that as my Lie algebra with the volume element, because while the volume is Hermitian, Chern-Simons is not, because it has a real and imaginary part. But as it turns out, if you divide that into y plus iq, where y is the real part and q is the imaginary part, then the real part of the Chern-Simons functional Poisson commutes with a volume operator. So that was a result that we found. So the result is you can throw away that real part, and what you're left with is the imaginary part with the volume gives you an affine algebra. So now we have our self-adjoint operators. So now we can make the correspondence to the algebra. And then now the next step is you promote those things to operators, which you're guaranteed to be able to do with the affine algebra. And so if you look at the state psi, that form unitary irreducible representations of the affine algebra, then from the mathematics of group theory, you would say that those elements, as long as they're gauge and diffeomorphism invariant, would form elements of the physical Hilbert space. Yeah?
You're being very arrogant, but you're skipping a step.
Oh, let's see.
I think you have to, I know, but I think you have to tell people that Q, that V with Q is the FEE term of the Hamiltonian constraint.
Yes.
And it's only equal to V again on solutions of the Hamiltonian constraint.
Yes. Yeah. So in other words, This affine Lie algebra, even if you did not have gauge invariance and diffeomorphism invariance, then you could only, based on the affine algebra, on states that form representations, you could only at most say that they solve the Hamiltonian constraint. They're annihilated by the Hamiltonian constraint in the quantum theory, but you wouldn't be able to say anything about the diffeomorphism and the Gauss law constraint. Yes.
Which on solutions of the Hamiltonian constraint is the same thing as V again.
Exactly. Exactly.
So you're
restricted to that solution space in order to apply the affine algebra results. Then as it turns out, we can exponentiate the generators and get the slide I showed you before that had Q and V. Well, really, that Q was meant to be the imaginary part of Chern-Simons, and the V was meant to be the volume of three space. So that's the integral of V of X, right? So if you take the integral, then you could interpret that as multiplying group elements at each point. Then now you can exponentiate the generators. And so you have your gauge and diffeomorphism invariant generators. And then the only thing left is you've got to find a state psi that's gauge invariant and diffeomorphism invariant and annihilated by the constraint. Did I answer the question? So those are a few of the results, things I just mentioned. And then, of course, the analogous construction that I said before extends directly to matter fields. In other words, if you have a matter Hamiltonian, let's say you take the whole standard model, it turns out that all you do is you just modify the dilation generator by a matter contribution. And there's a very nice formula for that that involves basically the Gibbon-Hawking's boundary term integrated against the density weight zero form of the matter Hamiltonian. And once you do that, you have back the affine Lie algebra. And then the physical Hilbert space is the same, but the generators are slightly different. So we got that paper published on gravity plus the standard model from that result. So now for the issues in progress. Well, they were issues in progress at the time that I made the slide. So we only have three Lie algebra generators. Well, I should say, I guess I'm including the identity operator as well. So they don't separate the points of the full classical phase space of GR. Right? So that's one thing, because normally you quantize a much larger space than you actually need to construct physical states. But we kind of did it in the reverse order in this approach. So now, the affine coherent states I mentioned before, that ground state that's the origin of the group manifold, if we could find a gauge invariant state, diffeomorphism invariant, that's annihilated by the Hamiltonian constraint, then an explicit example, then that would constitute the origin of the manifold. And then after that, you have a whole manifold of states labeled by points in the plane. So if you have one state, you have an infinite number of states. But the question is, we've got to find one state first, right, to claim a physical Hilbert space. And then, of course, trying to interpret, so what do these affine coherent state really mean in relation to space-time geometries, right? So how do I get solution to the Einstein's equation so I can check the semi-classical limit? So that was a hard problem. And then, of course, verification of the Dirac algebra of constraints. That one's sort of in progress. I'm writing it up right now. But in the past couple of days, I mentioned before, one of the reasons I came to PI for the summer was I wanted to try and get some help on these issues. And so speaking to a few people, they kind of pointed me in the right direction on what I need to do in order to claim that there is a solution. So in the past couple of days, we literally resolved these issues. So that's what I'm going to go into in the next portion of the talk, is we can go over any of the things that you'd like to see in any order, and we can go over in sufficient detail.
So you're claiming you can solve all quantum constraints?
Yes.
Yes. I guess I would like to see how you would do that.
Okay. Now, I wish I could give you an archive reference number, because we did post send it to the queue, but it didn't get posted, and the archive hasn't responded to my query. Yes. Okay. Does anyone have any questions so far? Because this will be more of an interactive session, and you can stop me at any time if you want to see something in more detail. But I want to make sure that I've addressed any of the main questions you might have. Any before we get started?
I guess the question is, what's the Hilbert space? But
okay. Yes, good question. So if you take these are affine coherent states. And think of that as being the a-axis and the b-axis. You have an arbitrary point, and then this point, 0, 0, corresponds to the fiducial vector. So this is equal to imaginary part of the Chern-Simons, the volume element of three space, acting on eta, right? So this is well defined mathematically. It's very easy to calculate these things in theory. But the question is, we need an explicit example of this eta, right? So that we can have one state. So a natural question I think you have is, so where are the gravitational degrees of freedom, right? Because they wouldn't be in A and B, which are numerical constants, right? And we want two local degrees of freedom per spatial point to say that there is that there is GR and not just generic affine group mathematics. So it turns out that the 2 degrees of freedom reside within the fiducial state. So these are 2 degrees of freedom per spatial point. So what I'll do is I will I'll go ahead and give you the explicit construction of this thing. So in the paper, we use the GNS. The GNS construction, right? So for rigged Hilbert spaces. And this comes from ordinary quantum mechanics. So you have some, let me draw it a bit bigger. So this is a kinematic Hilbert space. And so that consists of all the square integrable functions. So this is L2 and omega. And so this is the configuration space of densitized triads. So that's the Ashikar electric field. So you can imagine there are many square integrable functions of the triad. For example, you have Gaussians, right? Those are square integrable. And those appear, yes?
Can you write the formula square integrable under what measure?
Oh, yes. I will, for any measure, right? So if you have just the Lebesgue measure, so this is L2 with... Yes. So if you imagine an infinite product over all x ia, so where these are elements of the cotangent space at each point, sigma is 3 space. So the cotangent space of the configuration space. So now that measure, that Lebesgue measure, of course, is not gauge invariant and diffeomorphism invariant, right? But you could imagine, for example, in ordinary quantum field theory, right, when you do one loop calculations, so you expand the action to second order in the field fluctuations, so you're integrating a Gaussian. So you could imagine a situation where, in a suitable regularization, you get a result where an infinite product of things cancel, and then you have kind of something that you can nicely well say here's my here's an integral of this Gaussian over this this measure. So we know that at least in Feynman's PhD thesis, right, the measure is well defined for Gaussian things, but you try and go beyond that, and that's where you run into problems. Did I answer that question?
Going, because it's very different from the perturbative measure.
Sure.
And in particular, there doesn't seem to be, you know, I'm making use of a metric on the configuration space.
Exactly, and I'll show that. So it's not diffeomorphism invariant or gauge invariant necessarily on this large space. Now you need a dense subspace of the kinematical Hilbert space. So this is a dense subspace upon which the action of all the operators, which in general are unbounded operators. So, for example, including the constraints, you want those to be well defined on this space. And I'll call this phi. So that's a space upon which you do the quantum field theory. And you perform all the regularization. So when you put a regulator on the constraints, you're operating in that space. Now, the limit of removal of the regulator, because you have to remove the regulator in the end. So if you imagine a regulator that's parameterized by epsilon, let's see which board. Continue here.
Well, you can just move it up.
Okay. Oops. Ah, there we go. So if you define so it's a density of weight 1 parameterized by epsilon such that if you take the integral on 3 space, right? So it's a it's a weight 1 with respect to y. So that's the regulator. And in the coincidence limit, when x goes to y, this approaches delta 3, 0. And as a limit, as epsilon goes to 0, So that's what we use to regularize products of operators at the same point, because the Hamiltonian constraint is a local constraint at x at equals 0. Everyone get the idea? So here's where we do most of the quantum mechanics. But as I said, epsilon equals 0 when you remove the regulator doesn't exist on this space, because what's going to happen is when you take away the regulator, now the functions, which we'll see, which are regulator-dependent functions, they will go to the delta function, and they're no longer square integrable. So the limit won't exist on this space. So you have a larger space, phi prime, and which is the algebraic or topological dual of phi, and that contains the distributions. So I define this this phi, I call it the functional Schwarz space. So it's basically the analog of the Schwarz space in ordinary quantum mechanics, the functions of rapid decrease, right? So if you act on them with polynomials in P and Q, the basic operators, you get something that doesn't. You get a thing such that the products of the operators never increases faster than the functions decrease. So a Gaussian is one example. So that's the space that we act on here. And there's a very simple way of guaranteeing that that is the case, that you have the desired falloff properties. OK, any questions so far?
So what are the operators defined on that level?
So it turns out that the operators are polynomials in EIA. This is the triad. So if you take the inverse, so the densitized triad is, you know the relation between them. Kai. So when you restrict to the polynomials in those things, that includes the local Hamiltonian constraint. So we show that exists on the space. Yes. So. Okay.
So A is gamma by B.
Oh yes, this is k, right? So the act, so we don't use.
So a of I a. So we use this part of the connection.
Okay.
So now the thing is, we have to choose an operator ordering, right? We have to choose an operator ordering, and since the affine algebra is self-adjoint, then we need to go to the Wheeler-DeWitt equation and find a self-adjoint ordering of that equation. Now, to give you an idea, kind of schematically, Q looks kind of like integral of curvature of gamma. So self-adjoint ordering. And then there are going to be terms that involve k wedge k wedge k, kind of mixing notation. So three of these guys. So we have to take a commutator of this with v of x, right? So when you do that, the first term is pretty easy. You're going to get terms of the form just e, where e is determinant of the density of the triad times r of gamma. So this is the three-dimensional. So this is the so this is the 3D spatial curvature scalar on three space sigma. And it's actually, there's a factor of 2, so 1/2 plus lambda. That's a cosmological constant. And then you can imagine using the relation. Let me write it on this side here. Okay. There we go. Oh, I can even move it all the way up. Ah, okay. So if you take so you can imagine when you perform the rules of quantum mechanics, you're going to get terms of the form kke plus kek plus ekk, kind of leaving off the indices. So that's a symmetric Weyl ordering of the operators, which is also, which is self-adjoint. But what I really want to do is I want to reorder these things such that all the terms look like this, because it gives me a nice, simple constraint where I can, I don't have to worry about alternate orderings. So if you were to reorder these terms, these are all at the same spatial point x. So if you set x equal to y, you're going to get, you have to put on a regulator. And in place of the delta function of 0, you get this called f epsilon 0. Everyone get the idea? So this is a result of putting on a regulator, the regulating function. And so the Hamiltonian constraint becomes, I'll write it out. Cosmological constant. So in the process of doing that, you pick up these terms. And so the actual term that you pick up can be seen as a contribution to the cosmological constant that blows up when you remove the regulator. So it is 9/2 h bar g f epsilon 0 squared. And then I'm going to actually write out that term. So it is 1/2 h bar squared. Yes. Of that functional Schwarz space. Yes, so the functions of rapid decrease. And I'll give you an explicit representation of it. So that is a Hamiltonian constraint that we're trying to solve. And you'll notice that this term is rather nasty, right? Because if you were to remove the regulator, right, you let epsilon go to zero, then this term will blow up, which we cannot have. So the next question is, so what states solve that constraint, right, in what sense? So let's see, which board? This side? Yes.
So I'm a bit lost now at this stage. Uh-huh. So you introduced this nice affine group picture, right? Where you can actually define the operators Q and V, you can actually solve the constraint, you get a Hilbert space. This is all nice. Okay. So now you're introducing another Hilbert space, which to me doesn't have an obvious connection to what you do.
Yes.
So what's the point now of this affine group picture? Why don't you just start with the
usual, yes.
You know,
So the thing is that the affine group, it provided the motivation for the initial ordering, but ultimately we're going to have to remove the regulator, and that's where you could say that now you're really looking at something that you could say is the affine group element, and that's where you're going to get these delta functions.
But that discussion seems completely generic. You could make the same statements about any quantum field theory. It doesn't seem to use, at least I don't see it, where it uses this affine picture at all.
Well, the affine picture, I guess it just basically gave us the ordering to use, because we want to try and make we want to find an explicit example of psi, and for it to correspond to the affine algebra, at least the ordering, the same ordering has to apply.
So. One fiducial state.
Yes.
Then he can construct a whole family of states using the affine algebra.
But those
so
states,
now he's in the part of the talk where he's finding the one state.
Right, but this state is now in a completely different Hilbert space.
No.
It's not. Okay, then that's the point I missed.
This Hilbert space is going to give modulo details of the difference between the different Hilbert spaces that occur in the reconstruction. Is going to give a basis on which to represent the affine algebra. At least that's my understanding.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But okay, maybe it will become clearer when you show us some.
But I'm getting impatient to see something that's. Can you write something explicit that solves this?
Yes. Okay.
That will be your fiducial state.
Okay. So if you take. So I'm going to give you a particular example of a Gaussian. So this is. So here, so that's the regulating function. So it's a Gaussian in the fluctuation of the triad about, I'm going to define this as E sub IR. I'll define what that is. But these are basically constant curvature triads, constant 3D curvature triads. Then you have some M. So this these ER so the set of triads of constant 3D scalar curvature R equals 6K. And this comes from the, it's a result of the Yamabe problem that says, given any metric in n dimensions, we're applying it to three spatial dimensions, you can always find a metric that's conformal to it, that has constant curvature. So kind of labeling the metric in terms of a conformal factor and some other part that has the gravitational degrees of freedom, you could classify them by this constant k. So E sub r refers to the solutions that have those constant curvature. So you can think of a generic triad configuration as being a variation about this. Now, the thing is that since it's Gaussian, if you imagine a Gaussian where you kind of at each spatial point, you'll notice that the width of the Gaussian is tied to the regulator, right? So the width right? So if you met yes, go ahead.
That's okay because the regulator is in the regulated Hamiltonian constraint.
Yes.
But the ER are not in the regulated Hamiltonian constraint.
Well, they're inert, right? Because in field theory, this is a particular configuration that's defined on a
solution to the Einstein equation. So if you take its functional derivative with respect to the dynamical variable, you get zero.
So two questions. What are the m's?
Oh, yes, these things. So this is
The Hessian. It's some kind of Hessian matrix. For example, you could use here is one example evaluated at R.
One example is good enough, so hold that thought.
And this is a constant which you choose the value such that upon acting on the state, you cancel this infinity and solve the constraint.
So you have to cancel the infinity.
How, just technically.
How do you get the curvature?
No, I'm not concerned. How does, if you start to act on this with the 2D by DEs.
Yes.
You bring down some stuff involving M.
Yeah, so for example, if you act on E,
you get one F of zero. And then when you act with this on the state, you get this F of zero, so you get two of them.
But you have some dependence on ER through the M's. And plus the whole thing is a Gaussian, so things to multiply by E to the minus all that stuff.
So the thing is that for the Gaussian, what happens is it has to be solved for all configurations. So for the configurations that deviate from this, you can choose the width. So by varying the regulator in the limit as you try and remove the regulator, you can make this infinitely sharply peaked. And so the configurations away from that constant curvature configuration will be suppressed because you act on the state psi and those go to zero. So those configurations solve the constraints. And then at this configuration, if E equals ER, then you identically solve the constraint by canceling out that term.
How does the R, there are two R's in the problem. Is the R which refers to the solution of the Inari problem, and is the R explicitly up there?
Yes.
How do they relate to each other?
They're the same R.
So what happens is, when you act on the state, you can adjust this term, so alpha epsilon f epsilon 0 plus, there's a term, you could write it as k divided by epsilon, f epsilon 0, something like that. And the result is R. You could write it in that form. I think there is a 3k minus lambda involved, something like that. But when you kind of tabulate all the terms, then you can get it into that form. So it looks like this. And so this is for so on those configurations, that's the case, exactly to all orders. But when you move away from the configurations, then these terms remain, these terms. But because of the fall-off properties of psi, this term will go to zero faster than those terms blow up. So even though for any finite epsilon greater than zero, you violate the constraint, you can make that violation arbitrarily small as you let epsilon go to zero, because this becomes sharply peaked, because it depends on the width of the Gaussian. See the idea?
I think I'm still confused. Basically, the same question I asked before.
Yes.
What is special about gravity or the specific form of the Hamiltonian or anything about the details of the theory? Couldn't I make this construction with any theory that I cook up? I mean, the regulator is standard, right, that you introduce it. That's
so it turns out that no matter what
function you use, now I chose the Gaussian because it has nice properties in terms of Hilbert spaces and minimum uncertainty, because there's a nice interpretation of what's happening. Because if you think of it as, you know, the solution in the harmonic oscillator, that's the example I used. Classically, a zero-energy solution can have p equals zero and q equals zero, which is uninteresting. But quantum mechanically, you get this non-zero zero-point energy that comes from the variance of quantum fluctuations. So now you might argue that, well, that's similar to saying that I have the Amabi problem satisfied and the momentum squared equals zero. So that's kind of like p equals zero and q equals zero. So it's trivial, but it's not trivial because this contains 2 degrees of freedom per point, right? So there are 2 degrees of freedom per point in the Amabi problem that are captured, that you're expanding about. So how do we resolve the quantum mechanical p equals zero, q equals zero? Because that would violate the commutation relations. Well, while p equals zero, the momentum equals zero, p squared is not equal to zero. That's the thing. So you get the p squared term from here. That gives you the variances that cancel off this term and give you that contribution to k. So that's a quantum effect. That's analogous to these zero-point energy fluctuations in the harmonic oscillator. So the reason that the Gaussian is special is for those kinds of reasons, but also because we know how to explicitly construct the Hilbert space for Gaussians. We can get coherent states. So if you take any two solutions with curvature K1 and K2, there's always some overlap as long as you have a regulator on. But in the limit that you remove the regulator, those states become orthogonal, delta functional orthogonal. So no matter what you use for psi, as long as it has those fall-off properties, you're always going to have that situation where you cancel the terms, and it's not going to change this relation. It's just that the Gaussian allows you to visualize what's going on, then you can make connection to things like gravitons, another nice quantum field theoretical things. But in the limit, when you remove the regulator, now you're in this space, prime, where now psi's go to. Where this is defined as so they become distributional. And there's a nice interpretation of the measure of the space. Because there is a gauge invariant diffeomorphism invariant measure on this space of solutions. So if you argue that, well, because you have a regulator on this procedure, you've broken diffeomorphism invariance. Right, take that for granted. Well, as you try and remove the regulator, you can make that violation get arbitrarily close to zero, and it's exactly zero peaked on these configurations. But when you get into this space, and into this space, then they're automatically gauge and diffeomorphism invariant, and satisfy the constraint. Yes.
Constructing the psi equals zero. When you remove the regulator, then the whole thing is just zero, right? So, and then
well,
times zero should be zero. So.
But we're trying to mathematically rigorously show that, right? So, you put a regulator on the theory, and then you look at the limit as you remove the regulator, right? So, for any for any epsilon, you know, use epsilon delta arguments, there's a suitable topology on the space, then indeed the Gaussian, as we well know, approaches this. So what you have are these distributional solutions that are peaked on these configurations of constant scalar curvature. So that's something that you could argue classically that there are solutions to the Yamabe problem. But remember that this curvature K, right, is a quantum effect. Right? This didn't exist at the classical level. It came from the solution. It came from psi. So we have these things, this rigged Hilbert space. We have a basis, right? We have an orthonormal basis, delta functional orthonormal basis. But the thing is that you can construct normalizable states by superimposing these kind of states. So that's what we wanted to show, is that you can rigorously get to a physical Hilbert space that is indeed annihilated by the constraints in the appropriate sense. But then you get to this rigged Hilbert space, for which there is a well-defined foundation in quantum mechanics. So the only question left is, you know, so that it's not completely just formal, is what is the measure on that space, right? So if you don't have a measure that is gauge invariant and diffeomorphism invariant, then the whole thing is just a formal exercise, at least at this level, but not at this level, certainly. And you know what we found for the measure? It turns out to be the Lebesgue measure. I'll write it down. So it's the Lebesgue measure on the unimodular degrees of freedom. So that comes from the Wheeler-DeWitt metric, the DeWitt metric, because you can think of the invariance. I can show you later on offline, but there's a nice easy way to think about the Gaussian in relation to the line element on this infinite dimensional space, in relation to the measure of integration, in terms of covariantly transforming under these transformations. So I'll just go ahead and write down, you can think of these things as being fluctuations, right, that live in the cotangent space. When you're that are centered on these configurations due to the suppressing of these other configurations. Okay, and so I'll just write it down. The exponential, you can write it as that's what this is. And so this is kind of like ds squared equals g mu nu dx mu dx nu. So I think we understand this idea in infinite dimensional spaces. So you exponentiate it. And literally, that's what this, what that means. And then if you have a, you know how you have a covariant volume? Pardon? Oh, this is, that's the, so this is playing the role of MABIJ. Yes, but you use the Wheeler-DeWitt metric. And it transforms covariantly in the same sense here. But since it's if you use a unimodular version, well, you don't even use a unimodular version. You just put the square root of the determinant of that whole Wheeler-DeWitt metric, product over all points in sigma. And it transforms covariantly under diffeomorphisms in that limit. And so it's very, very nice interpretation that it made it all make sense. Yes?
Again, why do you have to use Ashtiger variables then? You could do the same thing for ADN, right?
Yes.
There's the DeWitt metric. You have a simpler theory, fewer constraints.
Uh-huh.
Why Ashtika?
Well, we're trying to make the connection back to the affine algebra.
Because we're really after a fiducial state. And so starting from the affine algebra, following the natural logical train, the correct operator ordering, then you get to a state. So now we can take that state now, and we have our 2 degrees of freedom already. So now we can go back and investigate, what are these affine coherent states? How do those act on these guys? So that was the initial motivation.
So that algebra just uses the volume, which obviously is a quantity also in ADM, I mean the local volume element. And the Chern-Simons function, well, I guess you could rewrite it in ADM variables. What prevents me from just rewriting this in ADM variables?
You can.
I was also interested in, well, what are the reality conditions on the Ashtikar variables? Because I was also interested in that. And so that was part of the initial motivation. But now that we've gone through the exercise, one thing we're actually going to do is we're going to redo this formalism in metric variables as well. But this led us, right? Because before, right, there wasn't a solution to the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. So how did we get to this? Well, it started from the affine algebra. That's kind of the historical development. And that's a whole area that is interesting to study, because it looks at things like, I think it provides a way of trying to solve the cosmological constant problem. Because the affine algebra had h bar g lambda. Right, that governs the size of the quantum fluctuations. With just h bar, that's ordinary quantum mechanics. H bar g, now you bring in quantum gravity, and that gives you the Planck scale, which is much, much smaller. And now you have lambda that's built in into a dimensionless constant. Right, so the smallness of lambda means that you have, allows you to have this kind of quantum theory beyond the quantum gravitational level. Because what if lambda were zero? What if the cosmological constant were zero? Then the volume and Chern-Simons would commute. But they have interpretations in quantum mechanics. It turns out that you can think of the volume as being kind of like a time variable on configuration space, right? So then what would Chern-Simons be? It would be kind of like an energy variable on configuration space. Well, how are those related, time and energy? Well, in quantum mechanics, they have to satisfy some kind of uncertainty relation, right? If there were zero, if the cosmological content were zero, then I would say that that's just classical. So that's another area that we're looking at, is trying to see how we can solve that the cosmological content problem, why it's so small. And this seems to provide a reason that we could look into in greater depth.
So did you look into building a Hilbert space out of that basis then?
Oh, out of this?
Yeah.
Oh, sure, yes. So, in standard quantum mechanics, for example, if you imagine the finite dimensional example, where you construct wave packets, you construct superpositions. So that's one thing. We haven't yet started actually doing that, but that we kind of alluded to that in the paper, that's one thing that could be done. And then if you try and look at... Sure. But then you also have a Hilbert space structure on this space as well, right? Because, for example, in LQG, they're kind of on a similar space. I think of that space as being the affine group version of the spin network states, right? Now, the spin network states, the classical limit is very, very hard to see. So what are they trying to do? They're trying to expand it in terms of coherent states, right? They take coherent states that are peaked on a particular geometry and try and see what they look like in the spin network basis, right? Well, here you have states that are peaked on a well-defined geometry. So the question is, well, what is that geometry? Well, I don't know if they know this in LQG. I mean, I've seen them try and do it about various things like de Sitter and so on and so forth. But here, the geometry that's very, very clear in that classical limit are these constant curvature manifolds that have the 2 degrees of freedom. So if you're just on this space, before removing the regulator, if you believe that there is some scale that governs a regularization, just like there's a minimum length scale in LQG, and you say, well, I'm going to restrict myself to the space and look at the implications, you could certainly do that. But now you know what the classical limit is. You have it right in front of you. And then you can calculate things like expectation values of observables. One interesting thing is that, yes, you have this regulator, but the regulator dependence will cancel out when you try and find, say, the expectation value of something, say, like the metric. Because you get factors of F that cancel out, and you get some nice expression. So you can calculate things like those expectation values. And then the nice thing is you can try and make a correlation to quantum field theory, because what do you do in QFT? You expand about the Gaussian approximation, right? So you have a Gaussian approximation. And these fluctuations, you can think of these as gravitons, right? Because because the width is becoming infinitesimal, that now these things are, you could think of them as living in the cotangent space as you get closer and closer to zero. So those fluctuations would correspond to gravitons, which you can study. Except things like these correlation functions, right, that come from interactions in quantum field theory, where you have all these non-renormalizable type terms and infinities. Those infinities, well, they're not really infinities, but they're regulator-dependent things, like in dimensional regularization. They would all cancel out. Then you can get results that you can kind of trying to interpret and investigate just on this space. But we were more interested in trying to get the exact space, the exact space in a rigorous way, right? Without just a formal definition. Thank you very much.